From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we look back at the past and into the future of Mikhail Gorbachev. Journalist Desko Doder has written a political biography of the Soviet leader. Mickey Katz was the Jewish Spike Jones, parroting the pop hits of the day, but in Yiddish. Coming up, we meet Don Byron, an African-American clarinetist, reviving the music of Mickey Katz. World music critic Milo Miles plays music from Ethiopia. And they say you can't judge a book by its cover. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg tells us what a book cover does tell you. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. At the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe, called the CSCE, Secretary of State James Baker stressed that NATO will continue to be the guarantor of peace for Europe. Saying the CSCE should be a high-level forum for political discussion, Baker said Moscow's fears about a united Germany being a member of NATO must be assuaged by all the organizations now in place to lead a united Europe in 1992. Paul Reynolds of the BBC reports from Copenhagen.
In his speech, Mr. Baker implicitly rejected Soviet ideas that the CSCE should somehow replace NATO in the Warsaw Treaty by saying that NATO should remain the military cornerstone. But he called for an enhanced CSCE role and said it was the one forum where nations could meet on common ground.
Though it lacks military or economic power, CSCE can resonate with a powerful and irresistible voice. It can speak to Europe's collective concerns and interests.
The Secretary of State put forward a six-point plan to reinforce the CSCE. This included annual ministerial meetings, more review conferences, commitments to democracy and the rule of law, and a major role in resolving disputes.
The BBC's Paul Reynolds. Five leaders of Czechoslovakia's former communist government were detained today for questioning about their roles in the 1968 Warsaw Pact invasion of Czechoslovakia. Those arrested included former Communist Party chief Miloš Jakeš. Justice officials said that Jakeš and three others were later released. Prosecutors said they were questioned about possible criminal acts in connection with the Eastern Bloc invasion that crushed the pro-democracy movement known as the Prague Spring. The men were picked up just 2 days after Czechoslovakia's first free parliamentary elections since 1946. A West German court in Koblenz today sentenced a former U.S. Army sergeant to life in prison for espionage. Deirdre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
43-year-old Clyde Lee Conrad got the highest possible sentence today for selling military secrets to the former Hungarian government. West German government prosecutors said that Conrad sold comprehensive defense plans that could have seriously undermined NATO's defense capabilities in the event of an attack. Conrad last served as a documents custodian with the 8th Infantry Division in Bad Kreuznach before his retirement in 1985. Federal prosecutors here say Conrad earned close to $1 million for his service to the Hungarian and Czech governments. This is the first time a West German court has handed down a life sentence for espionage activities. Conrad was tried in West Germany because of his civilian status at the time of his arrest. For National Public Radio, this is Deirdre Berger in Frankfurt.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials fell 13 points to close at 2,911. This is NPR. Federal prosecutors are asking that former National Security Advisor John Poindexter be sentenced to prison for his role in the Iran-Contra scandal. In papers filed today in federal court, prosecutor Larry Walsh said that Poindexter should be sentenced to prison even though others convicted in the scandal, notably former aides Oliver North and Robert McFarland, were placed on probation and assigned to community service. Walsh said Poindexter's position of responsibility in the Reagan White House made his crimes more critical. Poindexter was convicted of lying to Congress and obstructing its investigation. He's scheduled to be sentenced on Monday. One soldier is dead and five others were injured following a truck accident at an Army base in southern Oklahoma today. Paul Sund of member station KOSU reports.
Details at Fort Sill are still sketchy, but base spokesman Darren Neal says a 5-ton Army truck apparently overturned this afternoon during a routine training mission.
We had one soldier killed and five others injured. The MPs are investigating the accident right now, and we'll determine the cause later. We don't know how long that will take at this time.
The identities of the dead and injured have not been released yet, but Neil says the soldier who was killed was a member of the 2nd Battalion 18th Field Artillery Unit. One injured soldier remains in serious condition at a Fort Sill hospital. The other four are listed as stable. For National Public Radio, I'm Paul Sund in Stillwater, Oklahoma.
Vice President Dan Quayle was hit in the head this afternoon with a rolled-up bundle of newspapers. Quayle's press secretary says the bundle was thrown by a bystander as the vice president got into his limousine on Capitol Hill. Quayle was unhurt, and his assailant was arrested by the Secret Service and Capitol Police officers. The assailant was identified as a man from the Virgin Islands who shouted, "I have documents," as he threw the papers. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Perhaps no one man has had a greater impact on world events in the past few years than Mikhail Gorbachev. My guest, Dusko Doder, is the author of a new political biography of Gorbachev. Doder was Moscow bureau chief for the Washington Post from 1968 to 71 and from 1981 to 85. He went back to the Soviet Union on temporary assignment at least once a year during the rest of the 80s. Although he didn't know Gorbachev personally, Doder was in the Soviet Union during Gorbachev's initial rise to power. One of the most significant things to happen to Gorbachev last week took place not at the summit, but back in the Soviet Union. It was the election of Boris Yeltsin as chairman of the Russian Republic's Supreme Soviet. Some analysts have said that the only reason Gorbachev has been able to stay in power with things unraveling around him is that there's been no alternative to him. I asked Dusko Doder if Yeltsin might be that alternative.
Well, first, I think there's always an option, but, you know, we don't realize it. And second, I don't think Mr. Yeltsin is an option, but Mr. Yeltsin is sort of the Jesse Jackson of Soviet politics, who is going to create a lot of problems for Gorbachev, and who personally is now more popular than Gorbachev because he's telling the people, read my lips, no price increases.
When you say he's the Jesse Jackson of Soviet politics, what do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is that he poses the same set of problems for Mr. Gorbachev the way Jesse Jackson posed it for Governor Dukakis. In other words, there's an element of spoiler there, too, an element of pressure, the element of genuine issues that he wants addressed. But Mr. Yeltsin himself has no program as such. His program is fairly rudimentary. And yet he's very popular, and, of course, he is creation of Gorbachev, and in a sense, he's a testimony that some basic rudimentary democratic procedures have been instituted in the Soviet Union.
Well, Yeltsin may now be Gorbachev's biggest rival, but he was once Gorbachev's protege. Why did Gorbachev bring him to Moscow and put him in charge of city government?
I think that Yeltsin is known as a non-corrupt person, an efficient person who ran Sverdlovsk, which is a big industrial city. He's sort of a decent guy, Boy Scout a bit. And he was brought in the first wave of officials who came in to clean up the place and clean up the mess. And he took over the most corrupt of all organizations, which was the Moscow Communist Party organization, and he tried to straighten it out. But he did not really, although, you know, I personally sympathize with Mr. Yeltsin and his populist vision and so forth, he was not a very effective administrator because he's the guy who wants to do everything himself. And over the period of time, I think Mr. Gorbachev protected him. He still remains a member of the Central Committee, although he was not, when he was ousted as an alternate member of the Politburo, he was given a big job as deputy minister of construction, which is a big ministry, and remained the secretary of Central Committee. But Mr. Yeltsin now feels and says that he's no longer a communist, he's sort of a social democrat. And I think that in that sense, as an idea, he presents an option that it's going to be an emerging social democratic party in the Soviet Union.
Why did Gorbachev force Yeltsin's resignation from the Politburo in 1987?
I don't think that he forced his resignation, but rather that Gorbachev himself was forced to agree to accept his resignation, because Yeltsin complained about the pace of perestroika, and he said that it was not fast enough, not radical enough, and that at that time, number two man in the Politburo, Ligachev, who was the standard bearer of the conservatives, was the main obstacle to it. In other words, it was a personal attack on the number two man, the leading conservative. The Politburo was divided on the issue, and a majority of the people in the Politburo felt that Mr. Yeltsin had gone too far, and Gorbachev agreed to have him ousted from the Politburo.
How did Yeltsin make a political comeback after he was ousted from the Politburo in 87?
Well, I think that we sort of say that he made a political comeback, but what happened is that the system, the Soviet, Mr. Gorbachev has instituted political reforms. I mean, he has not been successful in instituting economic reforms, but in the realm of politics, he has been very successful. And he has broken up the hold of the Communist Party, as you know. I think his greatest accomplishment so far, when he peaked, I think, was in February of this year, when he had the Central Committee formally abandon, you know, Communist Party's monopoly on power. And he has instituted the elements, the rudimentary elements of some sort of pluralistic political system. And this is where Yeltsin fits, because he has been maligned by the majority of his colleagues in the Politburo. And he has come back with a vengeance. And he is popular because he's an articulate, honest guy who is, who is articulating the feelings of the common people. He's popular.
So do you think it's ironic in a way that Gorbachev's reforms made it possible for his rival to get into power?
Of course, but this is normal. I think that the very people, for instance, who benefited most from Gorbachev, and say, for instance, Lithuanians, you know, 2 years ago, if you talked about Lithuanian independence, it would be crazy because everybody said it's impossible. He made it possible, but they will destroy him. People like Lithuania, you know, all the people who benefit from Gorbachev in the end are going to destroy him. And that's why I feel he's sort of like a doomed figure, because he wants so much. He's already a historical figure because he has made, has changed the world and he has changed his country. And yet he seems to be bound to fail because he has unleashed forces that he can no longer control.
Do you think that that would have happened with anybody who was trying to create the reforms that Gorbachev created? Or do you think it's representative of a shortcoming in his ability to lead his people or to understand them?
I think it's inevitable. Anybody who did this would face the same kinds of problems, because what you have is you have a federal state based on fraud, on a lie. It's a fraudulent federation. That's one. Two, you have an economy that doesn't work, and it's a command economy. And how do you change it? Because for 70 years, the people have been told to believe in one thing, and all of a sudden, you have to go and change everything, from the bottom up. So you have this inability to deliver meat and potatoes to the people's table, which is one. And on the other hand, you have you want to create a genuine federation, but in the meantime, people's aspirations have come to the fore. It seems to me the question of Lithuania is almost, there's no way but the Lithuania is going to be an independent country sooner or later. The question is how and when.
My guest is Desko Doder, and he's former Moscow bureau chief for The Washington Post and the author of a new biography on Gorbachev called Gorbachev, Heretic in the Kremlin. Do you think Gorbachev's leadership style has been changing? For instance, May Day, when he was jeered, after that he allowed legislation making it a crime to slander the leader of the Soviet Union. Was that out of character for him? To do something as authoritarian, is that?
That's an act of anger, really, because it's... what has happened is that people have now been deprived of this ideal, and they look back and they say, hey, what have we been doing for 70 years? We have been deceived. And he himself has held up a vision now, but this was 5 years ago. They listened to him with, a gaping mouth, because he really was he's a spellbinding orator and a very charming guy. And he charmed the whole country, and you offered them a vision of the future, what's going to happen, how they all have to work, and so forth. But 5 years later, there's no meat, no potatoes, no bread. I mean, you have to stand in line. And ultimately, in every country, people vote with their pocketbooks. So they're unhappy.
And he's angry at them for being unhappy with him.
I think this was an act of... there's an authoritarian streak to him because, you know, he's inherited the throne of the Tsars. In Russia, I think he's the first leader in Russian history who actually wants to get elected. Because in Russia, the rulers either rule as the representatives of Almighty God or as, you know, the people who possess the knowledge of the communist mythology, and as such they knew the future. And here you have a man who actually wants to get elected and who wants to change the system. I think, you know, it's a hard thing to you know, after, you know, he's high-minded, he wants to do the best by his people, and then they jeered him. And it's a hard thing to take. I mean, in some ways, you know, Mr. Gorbachev is similar, you know, there's an element of Jimmy Carter about him, you know, a man who from the provinces who comes to the big city, he's knowledgeable, he really wants to do things, he thinks the world is made out of wax that he can mold. And then he faces these problems which are far more intractable. And there's also an element of Richard Nixon, who, you know, he's going abroad to find sustenance, to get approval, because in his own country he's jeered on May Day. And he comes to San Francisco or to Minneapolis or Washington. People love him. And I think it must, psychologically, you know, Nixon in 1974, you know, at the time of Watergate, he went to Russia and to the Middle East, and people loved him. In Egypt, he had a tremendous reception. But at home, he couldn't get out of the White House.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Desko Doder, and he's co-authored a new political biography of Gorbachev called Gorbachev, Heretic in the Kremlin. Doder's the former Moscow bureau chief for The Washington Post, and he'll be returning to Eastern Europe in just a few weeks. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Desko Doder is my guest, and we're talking about his new political biography of Gorbachev. Let's talk about Gorbachev's rise to power. Now, you begin your book about Gorbachev with a story about his parents. His father was a peasant farmer, and when Stalin was forcing peasant farmers off the land, how was Gorbachev's family affected?
Well, it's an interesting aspect of his life that his grandfather was... arrested and sent to Siberia along with millions of peasants who, for one reason or another, either opposed collectivization or did something wrong in that period of, you know, in the early 30s. And the Gorbachevs were come from the stock of free peasants, because in Russia, 95% of the peasantry were serfs until 1862, when Alexander II abolished serfdom. But in the outlying reaches of the empire, you know, they were settled during Catherine the Great's rule. The peasants were free, and they were given freedom and land to till the soil in exchange for serving the empire when the enemy attacks the empire and so forth. So you can see in Gorbachev's behavior when you watch him that he's a free man in a sense compared to Brezhnev or Chernenko or whatever. You know, this man is free, and he. But I think that this trauma of from early on, he realized that there were some, you know, really serious flaws in the Stalinist system. And I think that, you know, Gorbachev was a genuine anti-Stalinist, you know, from the very early age. And we know from his classmates and friends in school that this was the case. And yet, as an ambitious young man, he sublimated this, I guess, that's what we would say, and sort of became a party member and a faithful soldier of the party and rose in the ranks.
Gorbachev spent 23 years as a party official in Stavropol. Where is Stavropol, and what was his leadership style when he was there? Was he just a party man, or did he try to institute reforms?
Stavropol is one of the most beautiful areas of Russia, and it's not the part of historic Russia, but it was conquered in the 18th century. And it captured the imagination in the novels of Tolstoy, Pushkin, Lermontov, Caucasus with its wild mountains and Muslim tribes and, you know, subtropical climate. The Russians liked it. Plus, all Russians who could would always vacation down there. And when he became first secretary there, I think there's an element of chameleon about him, like in every politician. You know, he knew how to charm people, how to maneuver himself into a position. And his great fortune is that the top Soviet leaders every year would come to Stavropol on vacation. And once he became the first secretary, or sort of like a governor of the province, he was their host. So he met all the top leaders and was able to make contact, and one of the crucial contacts was with Andropov, who was then KGB chief.
No, and Andropov was really a mentor to Gorbachev, yes?
Right.
Since Andropov was head of the KGB, what kind of ties did that give Gorbachev to the KGB?
I think that Gorbachev inherited Andropov's constituency, which was the KGB, younger intellectuals, younger army officers, people in the institutes, people who wanted some change. In Russia, you have had a change of society in a sense that now you have a very large professional class. You know, you have something like 4 or 5 million doctors. You have millions of engineers. You have, you know, literacy is fairly high. These people actually would see where things are going, and they're going in the wrong way, and that something has to be done. I think Andropov's patronage was crucial to Mr. Gorbachev, because as the KGB chief, Andropov was, at least people believed, he knew everybody and he knew everything. Of course, you can't do that, but this was the belief. And as such, they actually took him on face value as a man who was going to continue reforms, but in a sense that Andropov started them. But Gorbachev has gone much farther and with far greater vigor than anybody anticipated.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Desko Doder, and he's the author of a new political biography of Gorbachev. What do you see in the future of the USSR? Do you think it's possible for it to remain as an actual union? Or do you think that there'll be so much breaking apart and secession that the whole shape of the Soviet Union will change soon?
Well, I think that the Soviet Union has two basic problems that will keep it in a turmoil for at least this decade, if not for into the next century. And that is the ethnic problem and the problem of changing the economy. I think that in any case, the Soviet Union is now no longer a superpower, because it has lost this mission in the world. The idea of communism is no longer there. What I feel is that the country is going to be preoccupied and looking inward. And as such, it's going to be a problem for the United States to kind of, you can have superpower only if there's another superpower there. You know, you cannot be one superpower in the world. When we will have to also to find a mission for, say, our alliance, the Warsaw Pact does not exist anymore, NATO is there, but, you have to find a mission for it. But at any rate, I see it as this is going to be a period of decline, with Japan and Germany becoming major powers, and in a sense, the United States, the decline in American power.
I wonder what effect you think it's having on Soviet politics to have personality be at the forefront of politics the way it's been lately, with the personality of Gorbachev and now Yeltsin, and their personalities being of great interest to Americans, as well as Soviets. You certainly didn't see that with Brezhnev.
No, I think there's been a change in the system as such, because all of a sudden you have an emergence of a number of leaders, the new mayor of Moscow is a reformist leader, Gavril Popov, the mayor of Leningrad. There are lots of people who are promising, who are reformists, who are more Western-oriented, I mean, intellectually. And I think still that the most important issue is the economy and whether Gorbachev and his people can turn the economy around. And I think the Washington summit did not give Gorbachev what he actually wanted to get. The rest of the trip gave him a little bit, I think the American business community was far more receptive. And I think that also it was important for him to be seen back home as a man who was respected in America.
You were based in the Soviet Union several years, 81 to 85, then off and on you'd go there to report through the 80s. Were you sorry that you weren't there on a more full-time basis as Gorbachev emerged in power, in the last 5 years?
No, in short, no. I think the work has become so difficult. See, in the past, Russia was a place where there was no information, and we had to scrounge around and engage in practically detective work to get pieces of information. Now it's a place where you are inundated by information and different views. And see, in Beijing, where I live, we can pick up Soviet television just like, it's a $20 attachment to the antenna, and you pick up the Soviet television because it's close to the border. And it's you have a feeling that, the sort of CBS 60 Minutes is every day, investigative programs, all sorts of interesting things. After the main news program, for instance, a priest would come 20 minutes doing a sermon on the importance of charity. The press that you read, the number of different views. So work has become very difficult, and it's very difficult to do a good job out of Russia now.
But you're going to be going to Eastern Europe to report from there and to write books. Why are you going there?
I think that, in a sense, what's happening today is in the world is that we're going back to the 1930s, in a sense, in terms of political alignments and so forth. And I think that the area of potential crises is in the Balkans. And, if there's a military conflict anywhere in Europe anytime soon, my prediction is it's going to be between Romania and Hungary over Transylvania. You have many of these old feuds there. The question of Yugoslavia is not quite clear. The borders here and there. And so I think that, this is what interests me. I'd like to see what's happening there, and that's where the story is going to be.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Desko Doder's new book is Gorbachev, Heretic in the Kremlin. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air. Next time, an account of the Alaskan oil spill and its consequences with Art Davidson, author of In the Wake of the Exxon Valdez. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet one of the more unlikely leaders of the Jewish klezmer music revival, African-American clarinetist Don Byron. Also, world music critic Milo Miles has new music from Ethiopia. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg deflates the hyperbole of book jacket blurbs. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The president of Liberia, Samuel Doe, is facing defeat at the hands of a powerful rebel movement, and U.S. officials say that he has asked Washington to help him flee the country. George Guetta reports from the State Department.
The reported request came amid continuing widespread desertions in the Liberian army and major advances by rebel forces. But rather than help him escape, U.S. diplomats have told Doe he should try to reach an accommodation with the insurgents. At the same time, according to officials, the State Department has been quietly asking several African countries whether they would be willing to provide Doe with a safe haven if he is forced to flee. Meanwhile, the State Department is arranging special flights for several hundred Americans to leave Liberia because of the deteriorating security situation. And if commercial departures are impossible, the U.S. Navy has four vessels offshore to assist in an evacuation if that step is considered necessary. For National Public Radio, I'm George Guetta at the State Department.
The president of South Korea says that he and Soviet leader Gorbachev will make a joint effort to, in his words, melt down the ice that still exists from the Cold War. President No Tae-woo met with President Bush at the White House today and said that a peace settlement in Korea could lead to more cuts in U.S. forces in South Korea. The South Korean leader is in Washington 2 days after his groundbreaking meeting with Gorbachev in San Francisco, the first meeting of its kind since Korea was divided after World War II. In the first formal congressional reaction to the trade agreement with the Soviet Union signed last week, the House voted today not to ease export controls in the Soviet Union until it begins talks for independence for Lithuania. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The House voted 390-24 against easing controls on exports to the Soviet Union. Last week, Mikhail Gorbachev and George Bush signed a trade agreement. The administration has always said it would not submit the trade agreement to Congress for ratification until the Soviet Union enacts a law allowing unrestricted Jewish emigration. But yesterday, there were signs from the White House that it might also wait for some movement on Lithuanian independence. The Soviet Union announced that it won't even take up the emigration law until the fall, a delay that may give it some time to work something out on Lithuania as well, avoiding a nasty battle in the U.S. Congress. Congressional leaders say it's unlikely that any trade agreement would be approved until the Lithuanian question is resolved. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Officials in East Germany say that inflated pensions paid to former members of the Communist Security Police will be cut sharply. Pension payments in East German marks will be converted one-to-one with the powerful West German mark when currency union goes into effect. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 13 points to close at 2,911.65. This is NPR News. This is Fresh Air. Many of us have come to know Ethiopia only through its tragedies, war, and famine. So it makes it hard for us to appreciate other aspects of the country. Ethiopia has a culture that includes pop songs and pop stars like any place else. World music critic Milo Miles has a review of a couple of the very few Ethiopian recordings to make it to the West.
Ethiopia enjoys a very vigorous popular music market with sales in the hundreds of thousands. Like much of the modern world, the medium for sales in Ethiopia is cassettes. But because of the ongoing political turmoil in the country, almost none of them make their way into American stores. I only know of two Ethiopian pop records with any sort of widespread availability. One is Ere Mela Mela by the long-established superstar Mahmoud Ahmed. The other is Aster by Esther Awike, a young performer who is even more eclectic than Ahmed. Comparing the two albums puts me in an unusual position. I hate purists. Hate them. But in this case, I must admit that Esther Awike is just too grab bag for her own good. She's been a performer for 14 years and understandably has lived in the United States for the last 8. Less understandably, she seems to be trying to cram every trend she can into her music. Admittedly, the album leads with its chin, starting with two horrendous rock and roll fusion tunes that feature horn charts right out of a bad Earth, Wind, and Fire record. Things do get better, and after a while, the record begins to suggest an odd but very decent sort of soul album. I don't doubt Awike's affection for American R&B, though she never quite gets the hang of it. Minus the hip-hop affectations, a couple of the slower cuts succeed with airy, lulling development. Although Mahmoud Ahmed has more traditional sources than Awike, this is not to suggest he's an old stick in the mud. He's heard and mastered the floating, quavering delivery common to Muslim singers in Egypt and the Sudan, but there's a sharp tang and a kind of crackle in his phrases that recalls the wise guy singers in the Algerian style known as Rai. But it's the off-kilter, wild and unpredictable balance of instruments that makes Ahmed's Ere Mela Mela consistently exciting. Some numbers begin with the expected swaying rhythms wrapped out on drums and bass, but other times guitarist Salam Sayoum will inject a great blat of wah-wah, or saxophonist Fedekala Amdemesko will trail a sinuous line through the background like dark smoke in a white cloud. One problem with Ere Mela Mela is that it includes no hint of what the particular songs are about, and they're so evocative you really want to know. Well, I said I was no purist, so I go ahead and make up a scenario that seems to fit the mood of Mahmoud. For example, the tune Ohoho Gadama suggests an interlude in a sinister night spot with tension brewing among the customers, a spurned lover lurking in shadows watching for a chance to start a fight. Ya chinte yimota ta ya chuem 8-minute title track of Ere Mele Mele makes a wonderful capper that could be a meditation on the eternal. As the coiling rhythms fade out, you feel they just stopped recording the tune that Mahmoud Ahmed sings on forever.
Milo Miles is a freelance journalist who writes about music for the New York Times and the Village Voice. This is Fresh Air. Klezmer music is Jewish pop. It's a hybrid that formed when Yiddish-speaking musicians from Eastern Europe moved to America and picked up on the sounds of jazz and vaudeville. In the past decade, klezmer music has been revived by third-generation Jews. But one of today's freshest klezmer bands is led by a musician who isn't Jewish. He's a black clarinetist named Don Byron. Byron also plays 20th-century classical music and jazz. When he was studying at the New England Conservatory of Music, he became a founding member of the Klezmer Conservatory Band. Now he leads his own klezmer band that specializes in the music of Mickey Katz. You can think of Katz as the Jewish Spike Jones, parodying the pop hits of his day, but in Yiddish. Byron not only plays Katz's novelties, he plays the arrangements that gave Katz the reputation as the modernist of klezmer music. One of Byron's recordings is featured on a new anthology called Live at the Knitting Factory, Volume 3. Some of the reactions you've gotten when people have seen you, a black musician, playing klezmer music?
It's different now than it was when I first started playing with the Klezmer Conservatory Band. I mean, the Klezmer Conservatory Band, I mean, that was pure shock. When I first started playing with them, I used to wear this big hat, you know, and everybody thought I was wearing this big hat because I was trying to look like a religious Jewish person. I was wearing this hat because I didn't want to see the first 5 minutes of people checking me out and not being able to believe that I was up there. These days, people pretty much, you know, their shock is done while they're reading the paper. You know, they already know who I am, who I'm going to be, what I'm going to look like before they get there. So it's not so bad.
You know, that old question, can white men sing the blues? I was wondering if anybody ever said, oh, can a black person really understand klezmer music? Did you ever get that from anybody?
There's a lot of mental gyrations that people go around seeing black musicians play anything but black music, or even sometimes more than one kind of black music. I mean, if you look at black musicians who play non-black types of music, it's usually the only kind of music they play, and in terms of getting to play that, it's usually a very focused kind of thing. A black classical musician will not usually be maintaining a high profile playing black ethnic, some kind of ethnic music or jazz. So that usually when you see someone like Andre Watts or any of the black opera singers, it's a long time down the road before they start singing spirituals and stuff. In general, It just takes people by surprise that I will focus on a non-black music and then play black music also.
Tell me what you liked and what you didn't like about klezmer music when you started to play it.
Well, I mean, I'm very objective about music, and that's one of my main principles in life, is to be objective about music. You know, I heard some klezmer tunes that I liked and some that I didn't like, and what I liked about them is pretty much the same things that I like about all of the music. There's a certain level of innovation, of avant-garde-ness, of whatever you want to call it, that I look for in music, and I've been able to find in all of the different genres that I've studied or played actively. And I heard that in klezmer, and once I heard that, that's what I wanted to do, was go to that end of the music.
How do you think your approach as a band leader compares with the approach of the Klezmer Conservatory band?
I think the Klezmer Conservatory band was relatively staid compared to the way, certainly, I conduct myself on stage. And my attitude towards the music is pro-weirdness and pro-fun. Mickey Katz in particular is very pro-weird and very pro-fun.
Tell me why you've been playing so much Mickey Katz lately.
Mickey Katz, to me, was the most advanced klezmer musician in a lot of ways. And I think his talent really got obscured, partially because of the whole comedy aspect, which I guess a lot of musicians who really focus on being funny and being entertaining, like Louis Armstrong, Dizzy Gillespie, Rahsaan Roland Kirk, a lot of times people tend to miss, you know, what musically is actually coming out. Mickey Katz had the strongest band maybe ever, and the musicians in the band were actually studio-level jazz musicians who were Jewish-American musicians who, even though they had total mastery of jazz or whatever, they still made time to play klezmer music and played it extremely well. And I always, from the first moment that I heard Mickey Katz, I was touched by the level of musicianship, by the level of arranging, by just about everything. And I just don't see that many bands focusing on his music. I just seemed like a good idea.
Let me play one of the Mickey Katz pieces that you perform, and this is Kiss of Mire, and it's a takeoff of the tango Kiss of Fire.
Cigarette, darling? Ah, chérie, a glass of seltzer? Oy, when I look on you, it's brennt bei mir a fire. Oy, baby, be mein guest and have a kiss from Mire. Oy, mein Herz is burning like a Roman candle. Come to Papa Bubble, I'm your continental. Oy, I'll melt you with a schmutzke and a kuss. Oy, will schwitz in some secluded rendezvous. Oy, my darling mademoiselle, don't be late. Oy, don't forget your shade to land your upper plate. Oy, you excite me, I schluck nit to genacht. I'm feeling...
Who translates the Yiddish for you for the song?
It's really interesting, because I think at this point, after being involved in just Yiddish music for about 10 years, I have about as much Yiddish, not non-speaking Yiddish, as someone whose grandmother maybe spoke, but they never spoke to their grandmother in Yiddish or never really learned. I mean, it's kind of like I know groups of words and I have some vocabulary, but I'm just not especially fluent.
Klezmer music is just part of what you do. You perform with the Mercer Ellington Orchestra, the New England Ragtime Ensemble, David Murray's group, a new group called the Rootless Cosmopolitans. Do you feel like you have a different identity with each band that you play with?
Oh, wow. Well, whenever I play any kind of music, I really, really make an effort to look at and what the sound requirement, what people are asking for, very separately. I don't really bring jazz to klezmer or klezmer to, you know, kind of a punked out rock situation like the rootless cosmopolitans. They're all kind of separate disciplines for me.
Now, you studied classical music. Do you play much classical music now?
I pretty much have maintained kind of a low-profile activity in classical music, but, you know, it's more important for me to be involved in kind of new music projects than playing in orchestras, playing Brahms symphonies and stuff.
How did clarinet become your instrument?
Basically, my family kind of has a little pool of instruments floating around that, you know, uncles or cousins or whoever have played and have kind of discarded. And my father played the string instruments. He studied violin and he played bass professionally. And, you know, I could just, if I had to choose between playing the violin and playing the clarinet, of course I was going to play the clarinet because I didn't want my father telling me what to do. I mean, not that that really stopped him or anything, but I just wasn't interested in playing the bass, certainly. And also I had, like, asthma when I was a kid, and playing a wind instrument was, you know, very helpful in terms of improving my breathing.
Was it ever hard to find a place for yourself in jazz as a clarinetist?
There is no place in jazz for a clarinet player. I mean, jazz clarinet does not exist. It just does not exist. I mean, except on a nostalgia level, and except playing swing music, except playing Dixieland. But, you know, even though I play in contemporary jazz ensembles, I mean, that's just me. That's not jazz clarinet. That's people relating to my sense of line and my sense of how to play jazz the music. But no one gets up in the morning and says, we need a clarinet in our band. People don't do that.
Can I ask what the ethnic makeup of your klezmer band is?
There's two other black musicians. Our trumpet player is Cuban, and I think the rest of the musicians are Jewish American.
Well, Don Byron, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us about your music.
Okay.
Clarinetist, composer, and band leader Don Byron. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. Today we'll be hearing some analysis of the voting results in California and elsewhere. In California, of course, former San Francisco Mayor Dianne Feinstein won the primary, the Democratic primary. It means she'll be the party's candidate for governor. Also, news from the Soviet Union, where violence in Kyrgyzstan, one of the Central Asian republics, led today to stones being thrown, rocks being thrown at Communist Party officials there. Some background on what the conflicts in that region are. And also, from Italy, I guess, what the world would consider the real news this week. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about.
What?
It's the start of the World Cup soccer tournament.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Maybe you can't judge a book by its cover, but the people who write book cover blurbs won't stop trying to sell them that way. This point was brought home to linguist Jeffrey Nunberg recently when he was looking for a good read.
A number of years ago, Bruce J. Freeman wrote a charming story called The Big Six. The hero, Mr. Lorsey, has a job writing jacket copy for a publisher of paperback novels, and the secret of his success is that he always uses the word vortex somewhere in the blurb. Like, they were caught up in a vortex of twisted love and strange desires, two people at odds with a world they had never made. On one occasion, Mr. Lorsey actually risked using vortex twice in the same blurb. Their lives a vortex of panic and infidelity, the bed they slept in was a vortex of shame and lust. Mr. Lorsey fully expects that his boss will catch on and fire him for that one, but instead he's given a raise. The story came rushing back to me after all these years, when I came home the other night with a kind of headache that makes even Jeopardy seem like an intellectual ordeal. I started sorting through my unread novels to find something to get me through to bedtime. The first thing I pulled down was the Bantam edition of Pat Conroy's Prince of Tides, which I recall somebody lending to me with a strong recommendation. I checked out the blurb on the back cover. Pat Conroy has created a huge, brash thunderstorm of a book, stinging with honesty and resounding with drama. Now, whenever you see a blurb that describes the publication as an adjective-adjective noun of a novel, you know you're dealing with a novel that fairly cries out to be called a blockbuster. Ray Kinsella's Shoeless Joe, which was the basis for the movie Field of Dreams, was described by the L.A. Times as an utterly disarming, whimsical knuckler of a novel. Another way to tell you're dealing with this sort of novel is when you find strings of words connected by and with no commas. According to the Boston Globe, Russell Banks' Continental Drift covers the issues of race and dreams and love and sex and power and fantasy in America. When reviewers are not joining adjectives with and, they run to alliteration. For example, one reviewer described John Barth's Giles Goatboy as a big, bawdy, and boisterous blockbuster of a book. This is as impressive in its way as Mr. Lorsey's Double Vortex. Publishers naturally like the word bawdy, which means that the book has lots of funny scenes with redeeming literary merit. When the sex scenes aren't particularly funny, you say that the book is provocative or searing. In fact, Vortex is only one of what must be hundreds of English words that have been saved from extinction only by the assiduous efforts of blurb artists. Where, besides on the dust jacket of a book, are you likely to see anything described as a mirthful, rollicking romp? Or see an author described as a haunting and lyrical new voice in American letters? And why does every review of an Ann Tyler novel end with, and above all, true? Doesn't she make them all up out of her own head? But as I said, I had this towering, blistering blockbuster of a headache, so I finally went to bed with The Sun Also Rises. It was a copy I'd bought at a garage sale, the first paperback edition published by Bantam in 1949. The jacket copy says, "Brawny Jake Barnes wanted only one thing, Brett Ashley, but neither she nor any woman could ever be his. It was truly a rotten way to be wounded." It goes on, "Only Hemingway, master of unspoken secrets, could successfully tackle this daring theme. Only Hemingway, greatest of realists, could weave this shattering novel of dissipation and passion and pleasure-mad novel." Well, it didn't live up to its jacket copy, but it wasn't half bad.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a sizzling, fiery barn burner of a linguist associated with Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Joan Tuohy produced the interviews on Fresh Air with research assistance from Lisa McCullough and Dan Buskirk. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by grants from the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, The Politics of Oil, with Art Davidson, the author of a new book about the Exxon Valdez oil spill. And we meet actor Meshach Taylor from the TV series Designing Women. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.